I want to read again from 1 Corinthians chapter 13, as this is the basis for what we've been going through for the last few weeks, and we're going to be going through for the rest of this month. Our focus is particularly on verse 7, but I want to start from verse 1 and read through verse 8. 1 Corinthians 13. If I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but do not have love, I have become a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and know all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains but do not have love, I am nothing. And if I give all my possessions to feed the poor, and if I surrender my body to be burned but do not have love, it profits me nothing. Love is patient, love is kind, and is not jealous. Love does not brag and is not arrogant, does not act unbecomingly, it does not seek its own, is not provoked, does not take into account a wrong suffered, does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices with the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. There are some people that when you interact with others, and sometimes people let you down, right? Have any of you ever been let down by somebody? Yes? No? Okay, I think most of us have. Some people tend to give people the benefit of the doubt, right? Like, I mean, if they mess up, you know, like lately, driving the streets of LA, I want to find ways to give people the benefit of the doubt. Like someone cuts you off and you go, you know what? Maybe they just, their peripheral vision's off. Maybe they just didn't see. You know, you want to give benefit of the doubt because why would they do such a thing? Like just cut you off. I mean, other than the fact that we live in LA and people do that normally, but you know, instead of getting angry at someone, or you know, someone forgets maybe an appointment you had with them, and you go, you know what? Maybe it just happened to slip their mind. You know, it wasn't malicious. So there are some people who tend to give people the benefit of the doubt, but then there are those on the other side who have absolutely no doubts about ever giving anyone any benefit. You do something against me, I know you are messed up. You did that deliberately. In fact, there are those who are quick to assume the worst in people. There are those who suspect the worst. There are those who give little to no trust at all. Because there are some people who believe they can actually read a person's heart. Now, personally, I think that's a little difficult to do. Because we can't. We think we might. But there are so many people who are quick to place judgment on a person. You know, there are those who are quick to find reason not only to doubt people, but then they magnify that doubt, and it somehow ends up in condemnation. You know, you did this, therefore you're an evil person. Or you said this, therefore now I despise you. And like, how did you jump so far so quickly? And this is done without taking any time to actually consider facts, what is true, but just going by perceptions, feelings, suspicions. Isn't it interesting? And sometimes I see this on Facebook. I saw this recently where, okay, hold out your hand, Dorn. I'm not going to do anything like suspicious. But, you know, they tell you to measure your pinky against your finger here. And depending on where your pinky goes in relative to that, where that line is, you know, if it's above the line or if it meets the line or if it goes below the line. Now think about this. There's only three categories they give. And so there are only three places where you get to fit. And based on where your pinky happened to be, like, did you have any choice in that? Like, did any of you, when you woke up this morning, you're like, you know, you try to stretch it out or, you know, push it back because you don't want to be in that category that you landed on that thing. Because other people are going to read that, they're going to go, let me see your pinky. Show me your pinky. And they look at it like, oh, you're evil. Just because of your pinky. Like, it's like the zodiac signs too. You know, some people read that. Any person born within that month, you are this. How is that? How is that so? Or, you know, I was Born in 1965, I was told that that was a very special year. It's the year of the snake, but not any snake, the white snake. And that only happens every, 2,000 years or something. I don't know. You hear stuff like, you're like, oh, so I'm special. If you're born 12 years later, you're just a normal, regular snake. Okay? But I'm a white one. I don't know how you match that with Christian truth either. You know, like, do I really want to say I'm a snake? Sounds a little shady, right? But then there's some people who make judgments based on that. Oh, you're this, you're that. And they're quick to then designate you in some way. I mean, sometimes it's something like based on like your body shape. Maybe how close your eyes are to each other or how far apart they are from each other. Whether you have earlobes that are attached or not attached. I mean, have you just ever looked at someone's ears and go, ew? Just because it's not like what you think is an attractive ear. I mean, it could be what part of the country you come from, your ethnicity, even what college you go to. You know, my gals are going to Masters. I actually am going to Biola, and they're rivals. I'm not sure what to do with that. You know, like, are we enemies now? But I did go to Master Seminary, so I'm not sure. You know, it's confusing. Like, how do you then really understand the value of a person based on those things? Now, why do I share all this? Sometimes I think we are very quick to run with something, and that really does affect actually how we love people. There are some people who are so quick to assume negatives. You might not really have a valid reason, but you go ahead and make judgment anyway. Now, everybody does that to some degree. But there are times when we actually do find out things about people that are not so nice, that are not so helpful. I mean, there's a reason why we question people's intentions and motives. Why? Because we get burned by people, right? You remember like in elementary school that someone promised to be your best friend for life? Just, can I have some of your lunch? Because you brought a nice lunch that day, right? And the next day you see them with some other friend. They're like, you're my best friend because they had a better lunch that day. You're like, wow, so fickle. That best friend status lasted for one day. And so you might then conclude for that person, I can't trust you. Because maybe next week you come back with another good lunch and they're like, hey, you're my BFF. Like, no, you're not. Well, there's a reason why we don't trust people. There's a reason why we do have doubts. And it is hard to love those people. It's hard to love someone when you find out that they have brazenly lied to you over and over and over again. It is hard to love when you find out someone has slandered your reputation. They've done all they can to undermine your character. And not only that, they have the audacity to refuse to pursue reconciliation and peace. And yet they insist they're blameless. It is hard to love people like that. It's hard to love relatives. Some of us have those relatives, right? There's always some relatives that make the whole family clan difficult. There's some that are even abusive. There are some that even when you show grace upon grace, they still act entitled, demanding, never admitting wrong. It's hard to love friends who maybe have become enemies, those that were confidants, and then they betrayed that trust. Now, it is very hard to love such people. And not only is it hard to love them, it's hard to believe that then people would actually change. I mean, think about this. For those of us who got married, okay, think back. I don't know, last night I was sort of getting all, I don't know, reminiscing mood. And so I looked at some of my old pictures of like when I got married. Okay, and I had like big glasses, back in the day, there were the big glasses, and I had a lot more hair. It was very like boofy. And But Angela and I mean, we look so young. You know, and it's like, well, I'll just speak for myself. Like, I don't look like that anymore. You know, wrinkly, puffy, things are not working. You know, yeah, if you're wondering, I mean, things are not working well. Things are falling apart. And you just go, wow, what happened? But here's the thing that I think that happens, especially in marriage. You know, early on, you think you know your partner, right? And things seem to be more or less positive. But what happens over the years? You know what happens over the years is you actually get to know more of each other's sinfulness. Maybe you didn't bank on that when you got married. You thought getting married was going to be like, you know, one of those Disney fairy tales, right? It's just going to just go, ooh, and, you know, it'll be nice and happy. And it's not that it isn't at all. But maybe what you don't count on is that you actually get exposed to each other's sinfulness more than anyone else's sinfulness. That's why it comes across sometimes shocking. You know, like you see the dark side of someone, and you're like, whoa, I didn't know this was going to happen. But that's what happens when you get closer with people. You find out more about their sinfulness. And then you go, well, I don't know. I didn't know this was part of the package. I thought it was just all going to be like lovey-dovey. Well, see, that's your problem. Well, what do you mean lovey-dovey? Like, what does it mean to love someone? Well, that's why we're looking at all this. And it's not only applicable to marriage, it's applicable in any relationship that you have with people. It actually is very difficult to love, and it is difficult to love where here in 1 Corinthians 13 it says, love bears all things, love believes all things, love hopes all things, love endures all things. Now, why do you think those four particular words are being used? That doesn't sound so romantic. It implies that there is hardship and difficulty, that you will be challenged, that you actually have this opportunity to grow in the depth of understanding what true Christ-like love is about in the context of being tested. But I don't think we like to think of it that way, because it's hard. In fact, when we say believe all things, I want to ask you this question. Do you actually believe that extending the love of Christ to difficult people is worth it? Okay, let me ask you that again. Do you believe that extending the love of Christ to difficult people is worth it? Now ask yourself, who are these difficult people? Some of them might be sitting right next to you. They, in fact, maybe are the closest people in your life. And you find out that they're kind of difficult. I mean, some of us would like to pretend, you know, every Christmas, well, you know, people are doing this less and less, but you know, they send Christmas pictures and you see the family picture and usually everyone looks happy. Right? Because you have to send a good picture to everybody, right? And you want them to think that this is what you actually look like all the time. And everybody in the family knows that is not what you look like all the time. In fact, maybe that very picture day, right? You were arguing. You were late because someone was taking too long to get their hair done, you know, and this person didn't like this and that. So you're arguing about the pictures. And then when it's time to smile, and then you have this picture. And then you find out later, you know, this is not what it actually looks like all the time. Now, I think that's a lot like church. You know, people come to church, and you expect it to be like a Christmas picture scene, right? Everyone's supposed to be nice. Everyone's supposed to be welcoming. Everyone's supposed to be like these pleasant people. And for the most part, most Sundays are okay, right? I mean, nothing too crazy happens on Sundays. But then sometimes you find out that not everyone here is always that nice. Like you see them in a different context. Or as you get to know them more, you find out that they have like quirky things about them. Like some people are really weird. They have weird habits and mannerisms and things. And you're like, oh, like you're not the kind of person I would like to hang around with because you're weird. But then you encounter conflicts. And that's something that maybe some of us were actually surprised that that would happen. And I'm not sure why you should be surprised. What happens when you encounter sinners as a sinner? Sin. Right? You can't avoid that. It's going to happen. But like we said last week, you also have an opportunity to love. You have a tremendous opportunity to love. So is it worth the trouble, the pain, the uncertainty, the lack of response, the rejection, the reality that it really hurts, that there are sometimes tears, there's frustration, and there is the constant wondering, even maybe to the point of doubt, that will things ever change if I choose to keep loving a person? So today we're going to talk about love believes all things. What does it mean that love believes all things? Last week we looked at love bears all things. We talked about how that is a picture of a covering, right? That we're willing to provide a place where people with all their sinfulness, all their weaknesses, all their weirdness and all that, that we give them a place where they will be covered, where it's safe, where they'll be cared for, where we'll be patient in trying to minister to them and encouraging them, knowing that these things just don't change overnight. What does it mean to believe all things? Well, the word in the Greek is where we get the idea of faith or trust. It means to believe, to have faith in, to have confidence. There's even nuances to be loyal, to maintain faithfulness, to be convinced of something. So you could say that love has this element of faith, of trust. Why? Because things are not yet where they should be. And the challenging thing about this is it will never be perfect in this lifetime. Now, is that a little discouraging? You know, I mean, some of you expect someone to be perfect. They're never going to be perfect. Now, when we talk about having faith, some people have very interesting ideas about what it means to have faith. Some people say, well, you know what? I placed my faith in you, and you let me down. Well, that's what people do. People fail. I mean, I don't know how many times, like, you know, when I would tell my girls, especially when they're little, I'd say, you know what? Daddy's going to take you out to 7-Eleven. You know, I see them get all happy. Why? Because it's snack time, right? And when you're a little kid, you know, and as a parent, you know, you learn quickly, what are the cheapest ways you can win your kids' hearts? You know, a pack of gum, what a deal. I mean, that's all you got to do. You know, I'm blowing it now, you know, letting it all out. But you don't have to buy a big toy. You don't have to go to the mall. You go to the gas station. I mean, my girls love the gas station. It's so funny. They would talk about that. Can we go to the gas station? Like, I don't know. Were you good today? Yeah. I mean, the bar was really low, but you know, you're just like, okay. But there are times I even let them down with that. I mean, the cheap pack of gum and, you know, a little drive to the gas station, I would forget about it. They get all sad and disappointed. I failed as a father. Now, I failed in many other things. I'm just using kind of like the safer ones to share. But you understand, you fail people. You get married, you fail your spouse. You let them down. I don't know how many times Andrew say, oh, could you take care of this? Oh, yeah, no problem. You know, end of the day. Oh, did you take care of it? What? Take care of what? I forgot. You should write it down. I did, but I didn't look at it. You know, I mean, there's so many ways to fail. And that's why so many times you find yourself apologizing. Because there's a constant sense of failure. Well, here's the thing. People fail. And when people fail, sometimes we feel justified in getting angry at their failures. We judge them. We condemn them because they dare to do what no one should ever think of doing, and that is, they failed me. No one should fail me. You always need to come through because who do you think you're dealing with? Me. Me. I'm very important. You shouldn't let me down. Now, mind you, do you ever fail other people? Maybe, yeah. Yeah, you do. But you maybe fail to think about how much you fail others, but you demand that people treat you a certain way. Now, if there's a certain reality that we have to constantly be reminded of, it's that when we talk about loving people, it is we are talking about loving people in a context where it is filled with sin and failure. It is not this fantasy picture where everyone's always getting along and no one ever lets anyone down. That is just not true. I think what happens that when we see this kind of thing taking place, we reveal that we place our faith in the wrong place. In other words, the object of our faith is misplaced. That's what we reveal. You maybe place faith in people, and then you place the expectation that they gotta be perfect. That's not gonna happen. Do you understand? And so one commentator brought up this analogy. How many of you like baseball? Okay, a few of you. I'm assuming the rest of you don't care for baseball too much. And you know what? I think you actually have a good reason. I love baseball, so I don't agree, but for the sake of the argument, maybe baseball is pretty boring. You know, it's kind of slow because, you know, the pitcher has to look for a sign. You know, you see the catcher, you know, making the sign, and then he does this, and now it takes forever, right? And then he throws a pitch, and then he misses it, so it's a ball. Like, oh my goodness, how many times does he got to do this? You know, and then they got to get three strikes to get him out, but then there's these thing called foul balls, so they count as strikes up until the second strike, but after that, you can keep fouling off as many balls, unless you bunt it and foul. And so there's all these rules, and you got to go, why this? You know, there's so much. Why are they wearing long pants, you know, with a belt? And, you know, sometimes hearing people's questions about baseball, it's like maddening, because you're like, let me just watch the game. But then at the end of the day, what's happening? A lot of them get out, right? And some games are pretty dull, yeah, because no one hits the ball. Now, you are considered successful if you hit the balls safely at least 3 out of 10 times, okay? That's what we call a 300 batting average. Okay? So 3 out of 10 times, you're considered pretty decent. If you hit it 4 out of 10 times, you are incredible. Okay, like over the stretch of a season. Now, how many of you would go, wow, you succeeded 3 or 4 out of 10 times? I mean, in an Asian culture, this is beyond failure. This is like, you don't deserve to live. Okay? Like, why do you even bother breathing? You're a failure. You can't even pass 50%. Right? That's like F minus. You're not even close. But if you know baseball, and if you understand baseball, you go, wow, he batted 320. That's pretty decent. And when they flirt with 400, you're like, whoa, crazy. I can't believe it. You get really excited. Okay? The four of us that are excited about baseball. Okay? We get excited about that. But you know what? That success is taking place in the midst of a lot of failure. Does that make sense? But some of us always see as the negative. I think that's why some of you don't get baseball. You're so negative. No, that's just true. Okay, but let's translate that to real life. There's a lot of failure taking place around us. In relationships. And because of that, we kind of lose faith. You know, like, I don't know if it's worth investing my life into your life because you fail me. Now, what would be a good example of this? Remember the story of Job? Okay. Now, Job is introduced as this godly man. He has a godly home life. He's a leader in the community. I mean, he's generous. He's wealthy, but he's generous. I mean, this guy has a great reputation. And then one day, everything falls apart. And he doesn't know why.
He doesn't know that some conversation took place in heaven between God and Satan. And, you know, Satan calls God out by saying, you know what? Oh, you know, well, God actually says, have you considered my servant Job? And Satan says, well, yeah, he only loves you and cares about you because you take so good care of him. You've blessed him so much. You go, you take it all away, he's going to curse you. So God says, go ahead, test him. Do you think Job would have signed up for that? I don't think anyone would have signed up for that. Because in the span of, you know, maybe minutes, he loses everything. He loses all his material possessions. He loses all his children. The only thing he has left is his wife. You would hope that's a good thing. Okay? But then his wife, her words are, curse God and die. Okay? Now, I don't know, you know. If I was Job and, you know, the only person I got left is my wife, and she, I would hope for a little encouragement. Like, hey, honey, trust God. Somehow we'll get through this. No. Curse God and die. It's over, buddy. I'm done. I mean, that would be like the kicker. That's just day one. You know? And then day two, Satan goes, well, hey, you know what? Let me touch his body. So he gives him boils. Now, I personally have not had a boil, but from what I understand, it's pretty painful. And he's got them all over his body. And he's using broken pottery to scrape out the pus. And he's got to be tremendously itchy. I know that part. You know, he's miserable. He's miserable. So you think this is a pretty bad couple of days for him. It doesn't end. You know what's the worst part to me? Is his friends come. His friends. And first they sit there for, I think they say like, I don't know, how many days? And then, because they don't know what to say. Now, that's smart, okay? Don't open your mouth and show your stupidity. But they eventually do. Because you know what they do? After they find, you know, Job finally starts talking. And he's basically started like saying, like, God, why? Why is this going on? God, why is this going on? And this is what his three friends say. Job, you're bad. We know you. You're secretly sinning. Oh yeah, you try to make yourself out to be this good person, but you know what? We know you mess around. We know you do all these terrible, sinful things. They accused him that his condition was exactly tied to the fact that he was this secret sinner. Wow. You know what? These friends were so quick to jump to that. They are quick to condemn. They showed no faith. Now, when you hear it presented that way, you might go, you know, I have some people like that in my life. Friends, right? They say they're friends, but they never got really anything positive to say. They're always quick to make judgment, even to the point of condemning. Well, before you go too much further with that, do you ever see yourself doing that? Where you're quick to show that you lack any faith in somebody just because you see them in certain conditions. And we'd like to think that we're above that. Now, when you look at the Bible, I think one of the things that makes the Bible actually so believable is that it presents very real human beings who are full of failure. Now, who would we consider to be like the heroes of faith? Well, thankfully, Hebrews 11 is put there. We call it the Hall of Faith chapter. And we see the names of all these Bible characters that are extolled for their faith. But if you actually read their stories, you'll know that their lives have a lot of failure. Let's go through it real quickly. I'll give you a quick review. Noah, was he a man of great faith? Oh, come on. Yes. What did he do? He only built like the biggest boat ever in a place where there was no water. I mean, that takes faith, you know, endure the ridicule of all his neighbors and then go through the flood. Everything else is destroyed and he gets to survey like a whole new, like clean earth. Literally, it's been washed clean, right? And then what does he promptly do? He grows grapes, gets a vineyard, makes wine, and gets drunk. That's the end of his story. That's the last thing we hear about Noah. He ends up drunk, a drunken old man. Good job, Noah. Way to finish well. I mean, maybe you shouldn't have gone with the grapes. You know, maybe you should have done like broccoli or something, at least get healthy, you know, but no, you had to go with the grapes and get drunk. How about Abraham? Was Abraham a man of great faith? Yes. Please, yeah, this is all the answers are yes. I'm warning. I'm telling you ahead of time. Yes. What did he do? Oh, he only left his homeland, right, to go to a strange land, right? And wow, he trusted God in so many ways. But there's one thing that he did that's particularly kind of sad. He lied about his wife. Like, ladies, were those your wives? Wouldn't that be the saddest thing? Your husband says, honey, you know, I mean, you're really pretty. You know, okay, that's good. Thank you. You're so pretty. Someone might want to kill me. So can you just tell them that you're my sister? How many of you wives would appreciate that? Anything for you, honey? No, what? You don't want to tell people that I'm your wife? You're scared? Abraham did that. And not only did he do that, like father, like son, Isaac did the same thing. And these are supposed to be the patriarchs, like the great leaders of the faith. How about Jacob? He was a deceiver. He deceived his own brother and father, stole the birthright. Joseph, he was arrogant and boasted about his favored status, got him in trouble with his brothers. Moses, murderer. Rahab, prostitute. Gideon, coward. Barak, sissy boy. Samson, he was a player. Jephthah, made reckless vows. David, murderer, adulterer. He was a lame dad. I mean, you read all the stories, it's just marked with significant failures. Now, how many of you, when you read these stories and you go, loser! Abraham, loser! Moses, loser! David, loser! Come on, you're supposed to be mad after God's own heart. What happened to God's own heart? You went with your own heart, huh? You did the Titanic thing. You followed your own heart. Lame! Lame, David! But these are the kind of people God used to impact people's lives for His glory. So how about you? Do you believe that when you see other people, that it's actually worth persevering in love toward them because you actually believe that God has the ability to bring good out of even the most evil people? Do you believe that? Does your love have such a faith that you would be willing to trust God, have faith that God, even if it would use your love to be somehow part of the process of bringing good out of people that you couldn't imagine good coming out of? I mean, think about Paul, the Apostle Paul. He murdered Christians. He murdered Christians. You know, I don't know. You know, I don't want to use anyone here because it would kind of maybe give you a dark picture toward them. But imagine if we had someone here in the church who was a known murderer of Christians, and then they said they got saved and they started attending our church. How many of you would sit next to him? How many of you would be willing to even let him come to the church knowing that he's the one that killed your parents because they were Christians? Would you? Would you actually believe that someone like this could actually change? I mean, for sure, not on our own. There's no way. Now, love, true love, for us, has this element where we must exercise faith. But this faith is not in the person. Love believes in God and trusts God that as you choose to love, that God is going to bring good out of that. God is the one who could change even the hardest of hearts. If you're a Christian, did He not change yours? I mean, no one could change your heart. You could try. Have you ever tried to change someone else's heart? It's impossible. I mean, you could be manipulative. You can be forceful. You could even be abusive. But that won't change a heart. You might change the external behavior because fear can do that. I know. I do that with my dog. And I'm nice most of the time. But when he messes up, Yeah, like when, you know, the other day, you know, we have this gate. He's not supposed to touch the gate. And so our girls were leaving. He was all sad. He's like whimpering because they're leaving. That's okay. I accept that. The dog has some emotions. But then he started moving the gate with his nose. Now he's broken the law. He's broken the law. Like, hey, 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 what are you doing? Don't touch. And he knows. He knows that tone of voice. He immediately cowers and he, you know, slowly walks away. Like, go to your bed. Go to your bed. He knows that. You know, in my, I guess, you know, humanness, sometimes I'm like, that's right. That's right. Bow to the power. Bow. Because you like having that feeling of control. Come on. Don't judge me. Okay? I know you all secretly want to exercise that kind of dominant power. Right? If you could just get people to do what you desire. I mean, wouldn't that make life so easy? No. We trust that God is the one who can turn the heart of stone into the heart of flesh. God can break the heart of even the most ruthless people and soften them. The part that we struggle with is that we are the instruments that God chooses to show His love through. And why are we called to do that? We do that so that we would glorify Him by displaying His love, which is full of grace, which is full of mercy, which is long-suffering, which is willing to be patient in the process, because that's exactly how God loved us and continues to love us. Now imagine Jesus. If there's anyone that had to be patient with some people, was it not Jesus with his disciples? I mean, Peter, how many times does a guy need to fail before you just say, you know what, we just need to move on to someone else? I mean, Peter fails in spectacular ways, not just little ways. He fails in spectacular ways. And Jesus still, you could say in a sense, believes and keeps him and gives him hope. And we're going to look at love hopes all things next week. How about John and James, the brothers? They were called sons of thunder for a reason. They wanted Jesus to burn down a whole village. You ever get mad at someone and Jesus is with you? You're like, hey, Jesus, I know what you can do. Can you just call down some fire from heaven? Fry them right now. I mean, these three were actually the inner circle. These were the guys who were considered top-tier disciples, right? These guys were the leaders for the rest. And you think, are these the kind of guys Jesus was counting on to start the church? Yes. I mean, from a human level, you'd have to say, wow, Jesus had to have a lot of faith. But it wasn't in them. Okay? Now, the only thing is, Jesus didn't really need that faith. He's God. He kind of already knows. But at a human level, you see that Jesus patiently loves them. How about the rest of the disciples? Actually, all the disciples. What was the one argument they had many times? It was who's the greatest, right? Even after Jesus tells them how many times, wrong line of thinking, okay? You know who's the greatest actually is the one who's the servant. And they don't listen. They don't listen. You know how frustrating that's got to be? It's kind of like parenting. Okay? Any of you parents, little kids, and you just try to get them to learn simple things, like straightforward things, like go to bed. How difficult is that? Go to bed. Do you understand what go to bed is? That means go into your bed, lie down, go to sleep. No, I don't want to go to bed. Why? Why do you not want to go to bed? I don't know. I just don't want to go to bed. I want to stay up. You guys must be doing fun things. Like, no, we want to go to bed. Can't go to bed until you go to bed. You don't understand, as you get older, you want to go to bed. There's not a whole lot that's exciting to keep you up anymore. You're just tired. Oh, it's so hard. And you can only imagine Jesus having to deal with his disciples. It's like, wow, they're just not getting it. They're not getting it. I mean, there with Jesus. I mean, imagine, you know, maybe say the context of a small group. Any of you in a small group? Okay. Maybe some of you are a small group leader. And you ever wonder if anyone in your small group's ever going to grow? Now, hold on a second. Are you Jesus? No, you're not Jesus. But even Jesus is small group. I mean, okay, it's not as small. It's like 12, okay? Let's say a somewhat medium-sized group. If there's any small group that should have been successful, shouldn't it have been Jesus' small group? Because who's the small group leader? I mean, should that make a difference? I mean, if Jesus was the leader of your small group, do you think your small group would change? You would hope so. But I don't know. There's no guarantee that your small group would be so great if Jesus was your small group leader. Because look at that small group. I mean, these guys ran away. Wouldn't that be the saddest thing? You're having a small group outing, and all of a sudden your small group runs away. They bail on you. Like, we don't want to be seen with you. We're embarrassed. They do that to Jesus. But Jesus displayed this kind of love that trusted God, that God had his good hand upon their lives so at the right time all would come to fruition. And Jesus even tells them that. He tells them before the cross, he says, you know what? After I die, rise again, I'll meet you. And you know what? You're going to be used to do this great work. He tells them that even before the cross. And they fail miserably. And they're hiding. And Jesus appears to them, restores them, and then everything then clicks. There is a certain faith involved that trusts God for the people that we seek to love. Now, secondly, it says love believes all things. When you first hear that, there are some people that jump to this conclusion. That's ridiculous. You don't just believe everything. There's some things that are false. Is that what it's saying? Is it saying believe anything anyone says? Does it say that you just have to take people's word even though they make absolute lies? No. You know, there's some people that actually say, you Christians are so stupid because you're actually told you got to believe everything. That's not what it's saying. Remember, you can't isolate one aspect of how God's love is being described and forget that there's so much more that you got to make sure it comes together with. For instance, love rejoices with the truth. Love does not rejoice with unrighteousness. We don't just allow unrighteousness to go on and do nothing about it, and we just accept it. That's not what we're called to do. While love is patient, love is kind, love does not take into account a wrong suffered. What we need to understand is, the context here particularly is that of personal offense. It doesn't mean we dismiss evil, that we never dismiss evil. We do address evil. But when we talk about personal conflicts, contention, division. You look at the story of 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians, and you see a story of a church that has so many problems with one another. What you need to see is that beyond just the problems, it provides, again, this opportunity that God calls us then to exercise His love. You know, you don't go to a perfect church. Well, first of all, there is no perfect church. But you don't go with the expectation of a perfect church. If there was a perfect church, you wouldn't even need the love. Now, this is maybe a strange way to think about it. But you know what? In order for you to love being patient, love being kind, you know what you need in your life? Some people who test your patience. Some people who you find it difficult to be kind toward. You can be nice to anyone who's nice to you. Right, we've talked about this so many times. Last Saturday, someone offered me a free In-N-Out burger. Oh man, I love that person. But and they said, "Would you like this In-N-Out burger?" And I was like, "Yes and no. Yes, I would like it, but no, because you know my gout, so I can't eat it. I'm sorry, but I love In-N-Out. Most of you know how much I love In-N-Out." Free In-N-Out. If you offered me free In-N-Out anytime, you'd be my seventh best friend. Okay? I gotta keep the family in there, but you know, you understand? There's a reason why God provides conflict, problems, contention, division, hardships in dealing with people. It's, in a sense, the laboratory for love to be expressed. Commentator Anthony Thistleton kind of describes it in this way: love never loses faith. So instead of saying love believes all things, he kind of just nuances it a bit in saying that love never loses faith. In other words, there are no limits to which true Christ-like love will continue to exercise faith despite the difficulties. His take on love bears all things, he translates it as love never tires of supporting. In other words, you're not going to place a limitation on how far you will go to exercise a supporting love. And I think that's actually a helpful thing to consider. Why? Because we do place limitations. We do. In fact, maybe sometimes we're fearful that someone might exploit the fact that we say that there's no limitations, right? Some people have this, you know, and I think it's not grounded in truth, is that an unlimited application of love will automatically assume that people will take advantage of it. And it allows wicked and evil people then to rule. No. Instead, I would like to tell you this: without the love of Christ, what you see happening in our world today is directly a consequence of a lack of love. And that's why I wanted to read 1 Corinthians 13, starting from the beginning of it, for verses 1 through 3. Without love, it's a very clear description of what's wrong when you don't have love. You accomplish nothing. You are nothing. You profit nothing. You speak nothing. Nothing good happens in God's sight. You know, last weekend we had the whole Charlottesville thing happen. People die, people are hurt, and people are angry, people are speaking out. I mean, everyone's giving their opinion on this, and everyone's calling out everyone else to, hey, where do you stand on this? You got to say something. And you do. You need to have a stand on certain things. But where does this all start? Like, where does this all come from? Why are people doing all these crazy things? Well, it's because they don't know the love of Christ. Everyone assumes the worst about everybody. That's what we see going on in our world. And it doesn't stop. It doesn't stop. It's just getting worse. I mean, consider the fourfold message here in verse 7 of 1 Corinthians 13. Love bears all things, love believes all things, love hopes all things, love endures all things. It's actually a package deal. It's all together. But think of it this way. If we stop bearing all things, believing all things, hoping all things, enduring all things, then we no longer love. Then the sum is nothing. The consequences are devastating. That's why it is necessary to understand that we need to love this way. Love believes all things. We have faith that God will do the work of completing people. You know, if we stop believing that, all we're going to see are people's faults. And it gives us more reason to then just doubt and then judge and condemn. Now, we find it sometimes easy to do that. What if someone treated you that way? That every time you fail, all it does is confirm for them how worthless you are. how untrustworthy you are, how faithless you are. And that's all they reminded you of. You failed again. You failed again. For how many times now have you done the same thing? How many times do we do the same thing before God? And yet God continues to extend this long-suffering love toward us. You know, when you refuse to bear all things and cover people despite their weaknesses and frailties, what you'll see then is a place where people are quick to expose one another, to see people as liabilities. There's no way I'm going to invest in people like that then. Why would I spend time with people that are only going to be a detriment? And if we refuse to believe and have faith that in extending the love of Christ that it will be worth it, then all our lives are going to be filled with is doubt, suspicions, questioning heart motivations, making immediate judgments. And then we refuse to change how we're willing to view people. We don't give benefit of the doubt. All we do is doubt. What kind of world would that be? What kind of church would that be? Sadly, there are some churches like this. There is no Christ-like love. Now, it doesn't mean you're going to have a perfect place when you practice this kind of love. But instead of seeing people as liabilities, instead, you would hopefully see them as God has given you opportunity to display and manifest the love with you, which you have been loved with, toward them. Don't forget, we are sinful people too. And we are with sinful people all the time. People will always fail. But if you really believe that God's word is truth, and that you believe that God's way is the right way, and you ultimately believe that God's sovereign purposes are going to be accomplished in the process, then you won't lose faith in Him as you deal with difficult people. Now, I will tell you, I am tested in this quite a bit, and I think if there's one thing over the course of my life I've really struggled with, it's this whole idea of loving in this way. Like right now, there's certain names, certain people's faces that if I just start thinking about, it gets me riled up because they've hurt me deeply. But then I have to ask myself, so what do I do? What do I do about that? Do I just exercise bitterness and resentment? Or do I choose to believe and trust God that, you know what, maybe through all of this somehow, God is going to accomplish a good purpose. And He will be the one who ultimately changes their heart. And so what little contribution I can make is this. I will show them the love of Christ. They don't deserve it at all. But every opportunity I might have, I will show grace. I will show mercy. I'm going to maybe struggle doing it, but it's because love believes. Love has faith. Love trusts God. And so I will show them this love. Now, if there's one, and I'll close with this example. If there's one example that I think had to be maybe one of the most difficult ways in which this love was practiced, it's the story of Joseph, right? In Genesis. Joseph's brothers hated him. They hated him so much they actually wanted to kill him. I mean, some of you have siblings. Did you ever tell your siblings, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill you. Now, you maybe really don't mean it, but you have that murderous kind of thought. These guys actually were going to kill him. They actually wanted to kill him. They wanted to shut him up. But instead, because one of the brothers kind of at least has the decency to say, don't kill him, let's just make money off of him. So they sold him. Can you imagine selling your sibling? Or imagine if your sibling sold you. If you have multiple siblings and they looked at you like, yeah, you know, we don't need you. Let's get rid of you. How sad would that be? Can you imagine Joseph as they sold him and as he's getting taken off with his caravan, he's looking back at his brothers? What do you think was going on in his mind? I think it's pretty sad. Not only that, he gets sold in Egypt to a guy named Potiphar, and he, being the kind of man that he is, he works hard, he becomes trustworthy, and then he gets falsely accused by Potiphar's wife. She just completely, blatantly lies. And can you imagine Joseph? No, I didn't do anything. I ran away because, how would he tell that to Potiphar, right? Who's the captain of the guard. He must have been a big buff guy who's pretty scary. And, you know, wife comes saying, you know, that slave boy that you got, he tried to make a move on me. No wonder Potiphar's mad. And then, what's Joseph going to say? Yeah, I ran away. She grabbed my cloak. Nothing he says is going to work. He got sent to jail. He's in jail. He even tries to help all the guys in the jail, but no one helps him. I mean, every step of the way, you think just when things start to get a little better, it's another huge drop. This guy's life has got to be so hard. But then finally, he gets to interpret Pharaoh's dream, and he becomes the most powerful person in Egypt next to Pharaoh. Now, that would be great. If the story ended there, you go, okay, at least he got something out of all that. But no, it doesn't end there. One day his brothers come, right? Because there's 7 years of plenty, 7 years of famine. So finally when the famine comes, the brothers come looking because they hear there's food in Egypt. And he sees them. He sees his own brothers. That's been quite a few years, so they don't recognize him. And plus he's all Egyptian now, right? He's probably all prettied up and he's got this thing on. And he sees them. And what do you think he's thinking? What would you be thinking if your brother sold you into slavery? And how many years have you had to think about this? How many years have you had to plot if you ever had the chance for payback? What would you do? So what does Joseph do? Well, we don't know everything that's going on in his heart. He had to have struggled, right? I mean, in some ways, it seems like he's playing games with them a bit, right? He puts some money back in their bags. Then he hides his cup into one of the bags. Sets it up so it looks like he has every right now to do what he wants. But then he ultimately reveals himself to his brother. He restores the relationship. He forgives them. He invites everyone to come. He lavishes them with gifts. And he says, I will take care of you in the midst of this famine. It's a great story. But it still doesn't end there. They come to Egypt. He takes care of them. And then Jacob dies. Now let me read to you Genesis 50, starting from verse 15, and follow the story. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph bears a grudge against us and pays us back in full for all the wrong which we did to him?" So they sent a message to Joseph saying, "Your father charged before he died, saying, 'Thus you shall say to Joseph, please forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brothers and their sin, for they did you wrong. And now please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father.' And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Then his brothers also came and fell down before him and said, 'Behold, we are your servants.' But Joseph said to them, 'Do not be afraid, for am I in God's place?'" Now this is where you're going to hear what sustained Joseph all those years. He says, "As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result to preserve many people alive. So therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones." So he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. Now you read through that passage slowly and carefully and imagine Joseph doing this. His brothers think that he's going to take vengeance now that the father's dead. Maybe Joseph just held back because he didn't want to disappoint his father. But as soon as dad's out of the way, you know what? Now's time for payback. That's how the brothers are thinking. They have been living with this guilt all these years. And even after Joseph restores them, they still can't get rid of this guilt. They think Joseph's going to take them out. And so when they present this to Joseph, it says that Joseph wept when they spoke to him. His heart must have been broken. But why? He had already forgiven them. He had already resolved that in his heart. Why? Because during all those years, he believed. He believed that God had a good purpose in it. You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. He could still love his brothers. He could still care for them. And it says there that he comforted them and that he spoke kindly to them. You know, that's a beautiful picture. Some people never speak kindly to anyone. Some people don't comfort anyone. This love that believes is a love that perseveres, even when it continues to get tested years and years down the road over something that happened way in the past. This is why love doesn't keep a record of wrongs. It doesn't keep bringing that, yanking that card back up all the time. Because the person who loves this way believes that God has a good purpose in all of it. He's going to accomplish that in his good time. So, we are called then to continue to have this faith-filled love. That we not lose faith that God is going to change hearts. For our fellow Christians, we know that God is not finished with the process of completing our fellow brothers and sisters in Christ. So be hopeful in that. Even if you can't see change happening right now, you know, sometimes you wonder if you invest in someone's life and you go, is it worth the time and energy when you don't see any change? In fact, maybe there's even times when they reject it. They treat you badly for it. No. Love believes God is still going to use all that you did to show the love of Christ. For those who are not Christians, yes, we still trust and extend the love of Christ because we know that God can change even the hardest of hearts. And I'm reminded of that every time I go visit my dad. God changed his stone heart. And I'm forever grateful for that. I want to ask you to bow your heads as we prepare for communion.